I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
All right, Bill Apter spent most of his career covering pro wrestling for Pro Wrestling Illustrated. It was the biggest pro wrestling magazine, the Bible of pro wrestling in the 70s and 80s, early 90s. Before there was an internet, before there was websites, before there was dirt sheets, there was Pro Wrestling Illustrated. Bill photographed so many legendary moments in the ring. He knows everybody. He imitates everybody. He's finally written a book about all of his experiences in the pro wrestling business. The book is called, get this, Is Pro Wrestling Fixed? I Didn't Know It Was Broken. That's Bill's thing. Is Pro Wrestling Fixed? I Didn't Know It Was Broken. Bill's motto, which he'll be saying over and over again. Bill is here with us this week on Talk Is Jericho to give us a sneak peek of his book. You'll hear why he had to sneak into WrestleMania 1, what role he played in Hulk Hogan getting the part of Thunderlips in Rocky 3, how Bill got Andy Kaufman started in pro wrestling, which wrestler inadvertently broke three of Bill's ribs in the ring, and what finally mended his relationship with Macho Man Randy Savage.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll. The remedy for boredom has arrived. The People's Podcast is here, and let's go for a ride with Bill Apter. He's got his brand new book coming out. Is Wrestling Fixed? I Didn't Know It Was Broken, and Bill will lovingly tell you all about how he came up with that title. You'll be able to get it on Amazon October 13th. Like I said, he's coming up and sharing some great stories with us today. Such a funny guy. I've known him for years. Very wacky, very goofy, very eccentric. Perfect candidate for being in the wrestling business for 35 years or 40 years. Lots of great stories to tell, and the book is great, and the show is great. So, and speaking of great, I went and saw AC/DC. Monday night in Los Angeles at Dodger Stadium. And man, I'm telling you what, I've seen a lot of great bands this year. I went to the Stones. I saw Rush. I listened to Van Halen from the outside, as you guys know. So many other bands that I've seen, but I'll tell you, The Who was great. But AC/DC takes the cake. Definitely the best rock and roll band in the world. Now, the Stones might be the greatest rock and roll band because they've been doing it for a long time. And don't get me wrong, the Stones were amazing. But AC/DC, you cannot compete with AC/DC. Because not only are they such a machine, meticulous in the way that they play and in the way that they run the show, but you know, there's so many AC/DC gimmicks for the production part of it, from the cannons and for those about to rock, the bell and Hell's Bells, Whole Lotta Rosie, the giant, the biggest, fattest lady in the world, as Bon Scott used to say. Of course, Angus Young with the school outfit on, his solo, just going nuts. I mean, so many great moments in that show, so many great songs in that show. And it was funny because I went to Dodger Stadium. Jack Slade, who has done drum teching for Fozzy for years, good friend of mine. His dad is Chris Slade, Talk Is Jericho alumni. The last Chris Slade show did over 1 million downloads. Unbelievable. And by the way, congratulations to all of you for helping Talk Is Jericho get over 100 million downloads. We're over actually 103 million right now. Thanks to you guys for listening to all the shows, and whether you like the wrestling ones, the music ones, the paranormal ones, the acting ones, the all in between, continue to listen. I got some unbelievable guests coming up. I got a lot of big plans for this show. So anyways, Chris Slade did the show. That was before he got back in AC/DC. He's now in AC/DC again after Phil Rudd was ejected from the band for legal issues. Of course, Malcolm Young can't play guitar anymore, so now Steve Young's in the band. So Angus had to reassemble AC/DC with two new members in a band that's known for being so machine-like and being such an engine and being so precise in everything they do. So it was huge to see them back and to see two-fifths of the band replaced. But man, did they ever play well. They sounded great. Brian Johnson sounded great. They played in Dodger Stadium. And that place was packed, probably 60,000 people. And I noticed right away, probably half of those people had the flashing devil horns that they sell, you know, the Angus Young devil horns. So those are $15 a pop, 30,000 of them sold. That's $450,000 right there, right off the top, to put that in your back pocket. And that's not even including the merch of the shirts and how much, you know, people paying for tickets and all that other stuff. So right off the bat, that's like $450,000-$500,000. I watched the show with a lot of different people. Brian Slagle from Metal Blade came down there and watched. Jim Brewer, super hilarious. Both those guys are going to be guests upcoming on the podcast. I got a chance to see my friend Solo Cup Jeff from Winnipeg, Manitoba. He came, of course, went with Jack. Marty Rubicabla, Marty Elias, you might know him as the old referee from WWE, and now he's with Lucha Underground. We had a blast. Watched the show with M Shadows, the good buddy Shadows, man. We had such a great time. We watched from about the 20th row back, had a couple cocktails, and just went nuts and just enjoyed the whole damn thing. Then when Angus did his Let There Be Rock solo, which I still love the fact that the band plays for like 10 minutes, I ran right up to the front. And as I'm walking to the front, there's a guy, I'm kind of cutting through one of the lines of chairs to go stand right at the railing so I can look up at the rampway where Angus is playing. And there's a guy, I'm saying, excuse me. And he's like, won't move. And he's like, you can't be moving. And I'm like, dude, I'm just passing by. I'm not bothering you. I'm going to keep going. Because you can't walk this way. And he's wearing an Angus Young schoolboy uniform. And he's kind of getting in my grill. He's getting in my face. And I'm like, dude, you're wearing the wrong outfit to try and be intimidating. You can't be intimidating wearing an Angus Young school costume. So get the hell out of my way and let me move on. And he did. And I went moving on, and I stood right by the rampway. I took some wicked pictures watching Angus go nuts playing the solo. All the bombs and fireworks at the end. I mean, it was just crazy. Such a great show. If you get a chance to see AC/DC, because it was the last show of their North American tour, the first leg, heard through the grapevine that they are coming back in February. So if you haven't seen them, or if you haven't seen them in a while, you need to check out this band, because it's the epitome of rock and roll. You know, it was so great. And I got to ride to the gig with Chris Slade and Jack, and we had the kind of an SUV, and they were complaining because there was no police escort. I guess every other city they played in, they got police escorts, except for London and Los Angeles. We did get a police escort for the last couple blocks to Dodger Stadium. Pulled in there like a boss, got out of the car, and promptly had no backstage pass, so they were trying to kick me out. But I weaseled my way in, but I'm Chris Jericho. Hello. And I got a chance to meet Cliff Williams, the bass player, who's just a super nice guy. Kind of freaked out meeting Cliff, because he's the one holdout besides Angus from the old days, from Bon Scott, you know. And I kind of, it's weird, because when I meet guys now, I don't want to be super over the top, like, hey, can I have your email? I've got this podcast. But you know, I couldn't bring myself to say it, because I just met the guy and he's super nice. So, hey, you got an email address so I can, you know, you gotta tread lightly in those situations. So hopefully I'll run into Cliff again and he'd be a great guest on the show. Love to have him on Talk Is Jericho. Love to have Chris back as well. But I think the AC/DC camp is very tight-lipped when it comes to press. But I'll get him back, hopefully. Got to meet Brian Johnson for the first time. And once again, super nice guy. A lot shorter than I thought. You know, I thought you'd be a lot bigger. How many times have I heard that? But, you know, he's super nice. And I was like, Brian, you sound great. And he's like, oh, my voice is a little rough, but I'll do my best, me son. He's calling me. He calls everyone, me son. It's nice to meet you, me son. And then Brewer and I were doing Lars Ulrich versus Rob Halford. He does a great Rob Halford imitation. I do a great Lars, at least I think I do. And so we were kind of bargaining back and forth. But he does a great Lars as well. So it was Lars versus Lars. Kind of like a spy versus spy thing, which we'll have to do on the podcast upcoming. Got to meet Stevie Young, nice guy, but just a really, really cool vibe backstage. Can't meet Angus. He's very secluded. I guess he doesn't come out and talk very often, but what a show. And to see 60,000 people there, one of the last bands that can play in a stadium and draw such a huge, huge crowd, and just a great night. So much fun. And someone asked me, how many times have you seen AC/DC? That was my sixth time. The first time I saw them was in 1986, I believe, on the Who Made Who tour. The opening band was Queensryche, which is kind of a weird mix. I remember I bought a tour program where Cliff Williams, his bass, instead of having frets like the little fret dots, they were a cock and balls. Yeah, his bass had a cock and balls for frets. It was a dink bass. And my friend Dave Fellows always got so mad. He doesn't have a dink bass. He doesn't have a dink bass. I'm like, I'm telling you, he's got a dink bass. He doesn't have a dink bass. So I had to drag out the program and show him, yes, he's got a dink bass, and here it is. So Cliff Williams ever comes on Talk as Jericho, I'm definitely going to ask him about the dink bass. I forgot to ask him last night, but stupid me. Then I saw them again on the Razor's Edge tour in 91 in Calgary. And the Ball Breaker Tour '96 in Calgary. I remember I went with Johnny Smith and Wise Cousin Chad. Johnny Smith, a wrestler back in those days, worked for All Japan Pro Wrestling. He was a Calgary kid. We went and saw them together. Then I saw, I believe it was 2001 on the Stiff Upper Lip Tour. Then I saw them again on the Black Ice Tour. Those were both in Tampa. And then Los Angeles last night for the Rock or Bust Tour. So amazing show, super fun, great friends. Eddie Trunk was there too, ran into him briefly. But there were so many people there, everyone was at the soundboard, and I ended up watching with Shadows kind of a little bit closer. And I also ran into, it's funny because there was a guy standing right in front of me who looked exactly like Gabriel Iglesias. And I was like, are you who I think you are? And it's like the dumbest fanboy question, but I had to make sure. He's going, yeah, it's me. And so Gabriel is also another guy who's going to be in this show, Fluffy. I've been trying to get a hold of him for a while. I follow him on Instagram, Fluffy. He's got a new show coming out on Fuse. But anyways, great time. My favorite songs were Let There Be Rock, High Voltage, Thunderstruck. What else did I like? Shoot to Thrill was amazing. So many great tunes, but I think probably Let There Be Rock and High Voltage were my two favorites because I love the Bon Scott AC/DC. But, you know, like I said, Thunderstruck is super powerful as well. So great times there at AC/DC. You should definitely go see them, and you should definitely stick around for Bill Apter today on Talk is Jericho. So many great stories coming up.
Talk is Jericho.
Here in Philadelphia. No, we just kind of hooked up here. And I watched your match tonight against Luke Harper. And what impressed me was that you were non-mechanical. Usually so many guys that have been around a long time, you know what that, like Ric Flair, mm-hmm. certain matches that he always did this spot where he'd fall over on his face, et cetera, or go over in the turnbuckle, and you kind of knew it was coming. Some of the things that you do, you know it's coming, but it doesn't look mechanical. Mm. Flair's didn't either. We enjoyed it. But what I'm trying to say is that it looks like you got in there and you were, it might have been a repetitious move from the past, but it was like for the first time watching.
Well, and that means a lot hearing that because we're here with Bill Apter, who you've probably seen. I don't even want to fathom a guess as to how much match you've seen. Tens of thousands for sure.
Abe Lincoln versus George Hackenschmidt? Well, no, go ahead.
Hackenschmidt. You know, and it's funny too because over the years, I mean, I've known you for so many years. And I think to this day, people still call, you know, magazines, if there's such a thing, pro wrestling magazines, it was always referred to as the Apter Mags.
Do you know where that came from?
Which would be Pro Wrestling Illustrated, etc. Where does that come from?
That came from, and this used to irk me, because I was part of a lot of really good teams, okay? Mm-hmm. Dave Meltzer in the Wrestling Observer started calling them the Apter Mags. And I remember calling him regularly and saying, this is really ticking off a lot of the people in the office here. He says, you're the guy out there. The promoters put you on TV. You promote the magazine. You give out the awards. Everybody knows you. So they're Apter Magazines. In the last few years, to kind of take the focus off of that, the magazines have called them the Weston Magazines, but they don't.
Because Weston was the original publisher
exactly.
of the magazine, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing is because, I mean, when I grew up in Winnipeg, up in Canada, we never got to see, for example, NWA or even WCW. The only thing, or, you know, Texas Wrestling or anything. The only thing I saw was AWA, which turned into WWF, and then, of course, Stampede Wrestling. But I would know all of the players because of your magazines.
Yeah. So you said your magazines.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean. It's the Apter Mags. I subscribed to what was the one where it was like Superstars of Wrestling where it would have the
Wrestling
fantasy
Superstars.
Matches.
Yeah, Wrestling Superstars.
It'd be like, you know, Steamboat versus, you know, Sting, who would win?
It would always be somebody usually from WWF
yes.
versus somebody in the National Wrestling.
Right, right. So you would read the ratings and look at all of these ratings, and every month, you know, you see who's like, I've never seen, for example, an Al Perez match in my life. or a Pez Watley match, or
I have to stop you for a second because you just brought up a name. I had no idea what happened to Al Perez, and I went to Dusty Rhodes' funeral in Tampa a while back, and this guy taps me on the back, and he's got kind of grayish hair and stuff. And I looked at him, and it looked like maybe it was an older Roman Reigns, and it was
Al Perez.
Yeah, and he's living in Tampa, and he looks great. He looks phenomenal. But you brought that up. I'm the guy who did. I can actually say that I'm the guy who did the rankings, and in the new book that I have is Wrestling Fixed. I didn't know it was broken.
That's the title of the book, by the way. Is Wrestling Fixed?
And I'll tell you in a minute where that came from. But let's talk about the rankings,
because I want to talk about, because I'm curious about it as a fan now into the business. So you would create these rankings?
No, I never created them. Here's what I did: on Mondays or whenever we had deadlines, I would start going through my Rolodex, and I called every office. The first office I would call.
Every promoter's office.
Every promoter's office. And sometimes if they weren't in, called some of the wrestlers. But for example, Monday mornings, if I didn't call Jim Crockett, he called me. And we went over the top 10 and we discussed.
What would he tell you? Like, these are the guys that are getting a push, or.
I'd say, what do you got coming up in the next few weeks or few months to make sense with the magazine that has a lead time that doesn't come out in 3 months? And sometimes he wasn't sure. But he'd say, Bill, currently this is what we got going on. Why don't you make Dusty number one challenger to Ric Flair? And little by little. And then so we did it that way. Then I'd call Vern Gagne, who always made like he didn't know what I was talking about. And he'd put me on with Wally Carbo or Greg or somebody. Vern never wanted to be responsible for anything. Then I'd call.
Because this is a different world then.
Yes.
You were probably the enemy because you were writing about the business.
Exactly.
Exposing, but, you know.
Yeah, well, no, we never
really
did any
exposing. Yeah, you guys always did it as a kayfabe.
We covered wrestling like Sports Illustrated would cover any sport.
Mm-hmm.
That was the mentality back there. From there, I would call Jim Ross, who would spend an hour and a half going over every.
I'm sure.
I loved it, but it was too. People would say, get off the phone already.
I can't.
Yeah, and then I'd call Gary Hart, who I loved. Gary Hart would go, my man, I talked to Fritz, and Fritz says this is what you should do. Kerry should be number one. Kevin should, and he'd give me the whole thing. Once in a while, I'd call Stu Hart, and I always had to listen to, well, I am, you're on Long Island, right? I lived on, and he'd go on forever. And then I'd call Don Owen in Portland, and Don Owen right away would put me on with his son. What do you want? Who are you? What do you want? So, and all my secret contacts that are no longer secret are in the book as well.
Well, one side story that's funny is that, you know, I think as wrestlers do, I mean, Stu told me the biggest marks in wrestling
Stu
are the boys.
Stu Hart. Yeah.
Stu Hart.
Oh, I thought that's Stu.
Stu Hart told me there's only one Stu on my side, which is Hart.
I got it.
He said the biggest marks in the business are the boys themselves.
Yeah, it's true.
So, you know, you would check those ratings and see where you stood. I mean, I think in my early years, the magazine was still out, and you would look for yourself. I think in WCW even, you could still find the ratings and the rankings. We were here in Philly a year ago, 2 years ago, who knows how long ago, and Flair and Brett were having some dinner, and you were there, and they were talking about the rankings, and ribbing on the square, which means they're joking, but they're not really joking about, remember in 91 when you said that Flair was above me in the rankings? What a joke that was.
And
They remembered it, and they were still had a little bit of heat about it, like, you know, it's freaking Apter putting you ahead of me. That was bullshit. Well, no, it wasn't. And this I was laughing. That was true, right?
This is why Brett talks like this. It's because he's got a sore throat from complaining about the.
How about where he was in the rankings?
I love him. Right. Now, also, people used to bitch at me, and I never wrote the PWI 500, ever.
Oh,
ever.
Yeah.
I never. But the two most important parts, numbers, were number one and number 500. Okay? And we used to go in to a conference room and rate the top 100 or 200. And after that, it pretty much became everybody was on the same level. But I would get a guy would saying, how could you put Tatsumi Kushinami Pasabaldo above me when you've seen me wrestle? You know, this type of thing. People, very set. I had guys back in. I loved, as a personality, Ivan Putski. He was great. He was really, hey, Polish Power, Bill. And he'd come over to me sometimes, and he was one of the best complainers. You know, Bill Vince Senior. Vince thought it. You put Mighty Igor and the NWA above me, and, you know, that's my guess. Him and there's so many other guys that I was friendly with, and they didn't know how to ask me to put them up higher, but they lived and died by those ratings.
By the ratings, yeah.
The shock to me of all time, though, was all the years that we put Harley Race over as big as he was in the business, and then when he came to WWE or WWF back then, that was all erased by them.
Because back in those days when you came to the WWE from another company, you didn't exist.
No, you were
like
brand
Dusty
new.
Rhodes, yeah. Flair, yeah. Harley, all those guys, yeah. were nothing if you didn't. And it's still to this day. I mean, unless you perform within the WWE arena, Vince doesn't really know or doesn't really care what you've done before. You know?
Let me ask you a question here, okay?
Please.
Where were you in the 500? What was your highest rank?
I think 1 year, and actually, just as a quick segue, the PWA Top 500 issue and then the awards issues were must-haves.
Yes.
Even as far as, like, even if I go in a drugstore at Christmas time and I see the awards issue, I'll still buy it. But the Top 500, I believe, I'm not going to quote this, and somebody, I'm sure, will hit me up on the Twitter and tell me, but I know I was number 8. And I might have even made it to number 4 or 5 one year, but I was never number 1. But I was pretty close, top 10 4 or 5 years, but I think maybe even top 5 one year.
Okay. So, there is a chapter in the book, by the way, about people who I loved to pose in the portable studio back in those days, and I could call them the posers. And there are a lot of guys who didn't want to pose at all. Ric Flair always used to say to me, "Sir, I'll be right out," because, you know, he always wore a suit coming in, and then he'd never come out.
Right.
You know, get it in the ring. Ricky Steamboat was a pleasure. And you were, too. You and Steamboat were just...
Well, I think that, you know, I was smart enough to know that publicity is publicity, and the more pictures you take, the more chance there is of getting
one
used.
The money I paid you for that also helped.
It's
yes.
equal to the money I'm paying you to do this podcast.
Thank you.
You know, and I want to talk about the book, and we're going to talk to you, but one last thing about the magazines is that to get in a Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazine, especially as a young guy, was a huge, huge deal. And I remember searching through the magazines for the first 1 or 2 years that I was in the business, or 3 years, just trying to find something, writing letters as somebody else. I think Clint Bobsky was my pseudonym.
That was you?
Yeah.
There's this hot pen pal, too, weren't
there's
you?
This hot young upstart in Calgary named Chris Jericho. You got to check him out. Pro Wrestling Illustrated. Send a photographer right now. Sign Clint Bobsky. And I would, you know, take it to my cousin's house across town and mail it from there, like anybody would ever find out where I lived. You know, but I just wanted to make sure. I'm trying to get in Pro Wrestling Illustrated. So to get in there was a huge deal.
Yeah.
And then in 98, when I won, I think it was the most hated wrestler.
Yes.
You weren't there at the time, but I told Stu, "You better send me a plaque." And he goes, "We don't do plaques anymore." I said, "You better send me one because I want one." And they did send me a plaque.
That's
so I got
great.
That on my
You know,
wall,
it's but. Funny because with you, there were so many people who would bitch and moan about not being in the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd ask me, "Well, you don't post. You don't,
right.
You don't give me." And not only that, you'll also have guys that were on the bottom of the card, all right? And for years, they'd come over to me and say, "You know, why don't you put me on the freaking cover of the magazine? You know, I'm working." Mm-hmm. And I never had the guts or really the knowledge to say the right thing, which is the magazine is like the business. You put the people on the cover who are going to sell. The publisher doesn't care
right.
about the business. He cares about selling magazines.
Yes.
Right.
That's right. Whoever, yeah, who was the top seller of covers? Like, you knew if you put this guy on the cover, you'd sell a lot of
One of the issues. Big covers we ever had was when Tommy Rich turned heel, and we had a tight face shot that I took of him, and we put on the cover, and I proved this with him first, and put "The Fans Can Go to Hell." That was one of the biggest sellers. You were very big on the cover, Sting.
Well, you know, another
Hogan.
Thing is, too, is the picture that when I was on the cover of, there was a couple times, but the first one was one that I took when you said posing probably 6 months earlier.
Yeah.
You never know when it's going to be used.
Right.
And that's why it's important to have
those
on file.
You, Dusty Rhodes was very big.
Huge cover
on
seller.
The cover. Yeah. Yeah. Sting, Hogan.
Remember the classic
the
Michael Hayes holding
whiskey
and Caravan Eric holding the thing of milk?
Yeah.
Everyone remembers that one.
Yeah, but those were a lot of the hot sellers.
Well, you've written about all these stories in your book, Is Wrestling Fixed? I Didn't Know It Was Broken. And I'm surprised it's taking
you... Do you want to know where that came from? Because I told you I'd get to that.
Please do.
If you don't mind.
Yeah, let me just finish. It surprises me that it's taking you this long to write a book with all the stories that you have, but where did you get the title?
When I was probably 5 or 6 years into the business. I remember this little kid. I remember we kayfabe was that you guys, thank God, let me be part of the business. I was on the inside. Mm-hmm. Okay, I was one of the boys.
Right.
That was more important than anything I wrote or any photograph that I ever took, was the fact that you guys made me one of you.
Because okay? A smart worker and a smart promoter realize that you can promote us, which makes us bigger stars. Sure. When we're in the magazine. So anybody that had half a brain would understand how important it is for you to be doing your job.
Well, and there was no cable TV.
Right, that's
there
what I'm saying.
There was no internet, so we
I knew who
internet.
Al Perez was because of you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Right. Thank you. But we were the wrestling internet before there was wrestling internet. And a fan in Georgia, a kid in Marietta, Georgia, and I still see him, he came over to me and said, "Mr. Apter, is wrestling fixed?" And I thought to myself, I said, "I don't break kayfabe because I'm one of the boys." So I said, "I didn't know it was broken." And he said, "Well, that's right. You can't fix something that ain't broken." And I kept that. So when I got the offer to do the book almost 10 years ago, and I signed a contract with ECW Press, which stands for Entertainment, Culture, and Writing, not Extreme Championship Wrestling. they said I have till September 2015, about a year and a half ago. So I had never written a book before. I had written columns and done stuff in the magazines, but a book is a totally, as you know, is a totally different animal. So I kept procrastinating, and then they said, you know, you've got about a year to do this. Greg Oliver, who was the editor of it, said, "When are you going to do this already?" So I started. I told my wife, "Leave me alone. And no, I'm not even doing the garbage." And I sat down and I started writing stories. And some of the stuff that I didn't remember that I did, thank God for Google. Because I found stuff from the early 70s that I did with Bruno Sammartino that I forgot.
See, that's the difference, too. Like I can say from my third book, when, for example, I had that big program with Sean, I went back and looked up the timelines. Whereas the first book, I'm going completely from memory.
Yeah.
So I'm sure a lot of it over time is eroded to where, is it true or is it not true? It's what I remember. But you can actually go back and find the exact stuff.
Exactly. Now, I don't read a lot of wrestling books. And the reason being is most people in the business, when they write a book, are negative about they're not happy about what's going on now, and they're not making the money people are making now. Or they're bitter. You read a lot of bitter. I didn't want to do an expose because that's not who I am in the business. It was always, "Hey, Bill's a good guy. You need something, go talk to him." And I did not want to put out a book that would make anyone say, "Don't ever let him in here again." Mm-hmm. Why did he do this? For 45, 48 years, we let this guy be friend. I mean, I became friends with
a lot of the guys.
Really.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, it's the whole thing. And so I started doing the stories, and I said there's two or three stories that have to be told that might be construed as negative, but these are not the stories about the magazines. These are stories about my personal journey in the business and about the way I was treated by a lot of people and about the way the things that I did at the magazines helped and hurt some people's careers. There's a chapter in there about with Vince McMahon Sr., was furious for about an Andre the Giant story.
What did you say?
Well, we were talking about, we'd gotten a set of pictures. One of the great people who was fabulous for publicizing himself, and I loved that, was Jerry Lawler.
Mm.
And we got a set of pictures, Jerry Lawler against Andre the Giant. And photographer or somebody who sent the pictures.
From a Memphis show?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Photographer or somebody, I asked, I said, "Who won?" He said, "Oh, Lawler threw him over the ropes." So we sat around the headline meeting we had every Friday, and one of the guys said, "Lola's like a midget compared to Andre." So we put out story the night a midget defeated Andre the Giant. Well, Vince McMahon Sr. was promoting Andre as the only undefeated superstar ever.
Oh, yeah.
Then there was a story about...
give us just a basic thing, the basic premise. Vince is very angry at you and calling you and yelling at you type thing?
Yes, extremely. And he was not a guy who generally... yelled.
He's like his son, Vince Jr. Although you should never
call
him
that. Two different people.
But Vince VKM rarely yells.
He's not a yeller. Vince Sr. never yelled at me. I used to keep in touch with him fairly regularly. He never yelled at me until this story happened. And Lawler was called on the carpet at the NWA convention that Vince and Lawler said it was Bill. I said it was Lawler. It's one thing, and I hadn't talked to Jerry Lawler after that for 2 years. Okay? Then one night, I'm backstage. A piece was made with Vince Sr. He said, don't trust anybody, including me. That's what he said. So I'm backstage one night, and somebody taps me on the shoulder. It's Andy Kaufman from Taxi. So now this involves Jerry Lawler, and I hadn't talked to Jerry in almost 2 years. Andy Kaufman wants to break into pro wrestling. Vince Sr. doesn't want any part of it.
Why did he not want any part of it?
Well, first of all, the State Athletic Commission in New York would probably never let Kaufman.
Because he wasn't a wrestler.
Because he wasn't a wrestler, gotcha. Right. You have to be licensed and pass the physical. Mm. And Vince Sr. was into wrestling, not into showbiz. Okay, he didn't have the vision that Vincent Kennedy had back then to make this still what takes place in the ring, but the window dressing around it was going to change completely. Vince Sr. didn't want to change the window dressing.
Okay. He's an old school promoter.
Yeah, but if you really look at it now, what goes on in the business today, it's the same thing. But again, the window dressing is totally different. Mm. Okay? But what goes on in the ring is still the same.
Sure,
thing.
It's still wrestling.
It's still wrestling. Yeah. Depends on what. So I get to talking with Andy Kaufman. He said, where are you going after the matches? I said, home. He said, where do you live? He's starring in Taxi, a national TV show. I said, in Queens, New York. He said, how do you get home? I said, I take the subway, the E-train. He said, can I go with you? So I'm riding back home on the subway with Andy Kaufman.
At the height of his popularity. Yeah.
We go up to my apartment. I'm living with Susan Sexton, my roommate, who is the Australian ladies wrestling champion. Every other word out of her mouth was the F-bomb. And we open the door, and she says, oh, my God, it's F and Andy Kaufman. So we're talking there, and for hours, all he's talking about is Buddy Rogers. And
so he was a huge, legit wrestling fanatic.
Oh, yeah. And Suzanne, after a while, says, is that all you can talk about? Buddy Rogers. She goes in the bedroom, turns on the Ramones, and her head, and we never see her again. So I said, listen, I know this guy I haven't talked to him in a while, named Jerry Lawler. And he said, oh, I've seen him in the magazines. But Kaufman knew who I was. This is what I got the chills over.
Because of the After magazine.
Yeah, he was. And so it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and I said, I'm going to call Jerry Lawler. I'd kind of chatted with Jerry a few times during the 2 years of where we weren't talking because we were kind of blaming each other, but not really. And it's a great story, though. It really was. And by the way, just to backtrack, we had to put out a magazine calling Andre the Giant Wrestling's only undefeated superstar. So that
fixed was kind of like your
ipso
facto apology.
Right. Yeah. So now we call
retraction.
Lawler. Yes. Yeah. We call Lawler now, and he says, "You got Andy Kaufman, the star of Taxi, in your little roach infested apartment in Queens." And I said, "Yeah," and I put him on the phone. So that's how.
That's how it started.
That's how it started, and there's a full chapter about that in the book. But this now involves Lawler, who I didn't talk to forever, and Vince Sr., who didn't want Andy Kaufman to wrestle. And I found out ages and ages later from one of the wrestlers that was sitting with Vincent Kennedy McMahon on an airplane, and he said, the one angle I wish I would have had was Andy Kaufman, Jerry Lawler, and he didn't even know that it was me that put the two of them together. I was down at the Performance Center when the WWE opened the Performance Center. I was invited down as press. And Paul, Triple H, knows everything about wrestling. And I just said to him and Stephanie, just out of curiosity, do you two know who put Andy Kaufman and Jerry Lawler together? And neither of them knew. And Stephanie said, it was you? Yeah. So that's in there. Then there's a chapter about Randy Savage almost wanted to kill me one time. And it was where he was wrestling Ric Flair at an arena in Philadelphia, and he was so upset at me, he stopped the match halfway through, came over to where I was standing with Nancy Benoit, who was fondling my hair while I was shooting pictures, and spit in my face.
And you're ringside.
I'm ringside. Spit in my face, just the same wad that Bret Hart did with Vincent Kennedy.
So, but Savage, and you don't have to get too much into it, but Savage was a pretty intense guy.
He was very volatile.
Tell us a little bit about that.
He was very sensitive. He and some of the other guys, like Scott Steiner, you never knew, and Scott Hall, you never knew what you got until they were never the same almost twice. You never know what you got until you were there and talking with them. There were some nights, this one period of time with Savage, that terrified me to the point where rumor was around the business. I'd seen Eric Bischoff at the Peace Festival in Los Angeles. I remember. Yeah. I met you there. And Eric Bischoff said to me, by the way, Randy Savage wants to kill you.
So this was a long-term thing. Over
this is a very long. Yeah. And the title, very simply, is how an "oh yeah" became a terrifying "oh no."
That's the title of the chapter.
And it's about a story that we wrote about him where he approved the headline, and then when it came out, he went crazy. Mm. He literally went. And his brother told me why. It hurts me because the way things ended with him, and we did Hulk Hogan is the guy who I went to visit Hogan one time before we went to his house. He drove me to this little donkey gym, and there was Savage sitting there, and we talked, and everything.
Did you get to smooth
over.
It out?
Yeah.
Before he passed
yeah.
away? Well, that's good.
Yes.
Then.
Yeah. That's we good. Really did. We really did.
So how about?
There was one time that Fritz von Erich wanted to kill me.
What did you do?
Oh my God! I didn't do. We had Dan Shockett was real. Mm-hmm. Okay, he was a real guy. Everybody thinks Apter wrote all these people. I never wrote anybody.
Dan Shockett.
Dan Shockett,
one of the columnists right,
Inside okay. Wrestling. And Eddie Ellner was also real. You can find Eddie Ellner, our other heel reporter, online. If you go to Google, he owns a thing called Yoga Soup out in California.
Oh, so people thought that you were just using all
these
pseudonyms.
I was both. I was, yes.
All these guys. Like
and,
you were
now, Dan
the whole
Shockett
magazine.
Died of cancer at okay. a very young age. Dan wrote a story comparing David, Kerry, and Kevin Von Erich to the Three Stooges. Okay, fine. I figured Gary Hart would tell Fritz about this. Fritz is very old. Fritz, the dad, mm-hmm. was very old school. And if he gets it, fine. If he doesn't, I'm sorry. The magazine came out at the same time David Von Erich died.
Oh, okay.
Gary Hart calls me one day and says, "My man, Fritz wants to kill you. You're out of the family." Yeah, I was. They called me the fourth Von Erich. I was so close with them, and they were going to do the Parade of Champions, where Kerry was wrestling Ric Flair, memorial
famous,
for David Von. Yeah, Texas Stadium. Yeah, and I was told by Gary Hart, "Don't show up. Fritz doesn't want you there." That hurt me for two reasons. Number one, I felt very close to the family. Number two, I don't like anybody not to like me. I've always been like that. If I found out a wrestler says, you know, after I find, please find him, let me talk to him, mm-hmm. please. Mm-hmm. And in my personal life, it's the same way, too. I don't like people not to like me. So then it was smoothed over. And then, of course, there's...
So, for example, just let me say, if you're not allowed at Texas Stadium, for mm-hmm. example, somebody else from Pro Wrestling Illustrated is still allowed to go shoot, just not you, or is the magazine banned?
It was Bill was banned. They didn't want to entertain anything with anything I had anything to do
so
with.
So Pro Wrestling Illustrated is not allowed to show up?
He never said that. He just said, you better not show up. So there was no thought I was the magazine to them, period.
Right.
End. Craig Peters, one of our associate editors, went down there with me, too, just in case I was killed, we'd have a second photographer.
Of course. Well, because the show must go on. Yeah.
Right.
Bill Apter is here, and there was a time when Vince McMahon Jr., the Vince McMahon VKM, he actually banned you from WWE matches. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it wasn't me. No, it was a company decision. It was a company decision by Vince McMahon to not allow the wrestling magazines any access. And this is not in the book because this is stuff that went on strictly with the magazines. This may be a paragraph mm-hmm. on it. I don't want to be a spokesman for the magazine.
No, I understand, but the point is that Vince would...
We were banned.
You guys were banned.
We were banned.
Because he had his own magazine?
He had his own magazine, and we were competition.
Right.
He allegedly, he didn't kill anyone, he allegedly went to the distributors and said, don't take these guys because we're going to put them out of business.
Oh, to the publisher? Or
yeah,
to the
distributors.
Oh, like distributing the
yeah,
mags to
exactly.
Targets
went,
or
these guys are no longer going to be allowed. Vince Sr. cornered me at an NWA convention. He said, what are you saying about my son? Because Ole Anderson had gotten up, and Ole was a very funny but volatile person. I'm one of the few people who got along with him. And he was saying that Junior's, you know, trying to put us all out of business. And he said, he's trying to put the frickin' magazines out of business, too. So Vince Sr. was saying, talk to my son, talk to Junior. And Vincent Kennedy Jr. offered me a job at that point. But I was very well taken care of by Stanley Weston, the publisher. And I said, call Les Thatcher. He puts out an NWA magazine that's really good. I think he'd be great to do this. So we were dumped out for years and years and years.
So how would you cover WWF?
I rarely went. A lot of the wrestlers would call me at home and say, I'm going to be in Long Island. I can meet you at a hotel and I'll pose for you.
Oh, so they would do that on their own time?
And I'll say, aren't you going to get in trouble? They said, hell no, I'm a top guy. They're not going to fire me for this.
Gotcha.
They need me. They need me.
Because once again, the boys know that the more
when
publicity.
I did WOW magazine, when I was the editor, when I left PWI to go to WOW magazine, Shane McMahon was in charge of the magazines and the social media back then. I was told everyone in that department went ballistic when I left PWI and went to there because WOW magazine, before I got there, I didn't go there till the third issue, was paying people to pose for them on the cover. They paid Sable like $10,000,
which was unheard of before to get paid.
Yeah,
to do
and that was getting around. And I remember talking to Linda McMahon saying they've made me a great offer. She said, "Listen, you're still family to us, but if you go to them, we can't help you at all." So we were still kind of banned with WWF back then, but enough where it's okay if Bill comes in, just don't bring a camera and don't bring a recorder. But there were people paranoid in that office that thought if I was backstage, which is why you didn't see me for years backstage, that he's probably got a camera in his nose. And if he presses his nose,
he's a James Bond gimmick, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then one of the hottest things and the hardest things in the whole world was one time Stanley Weston, the boss, called me in. And again, this is in the book. Is wrestling fixed? I didn't know it was broken. On sale shortly,
soon.
Or it depends if you're listening to this in 2017.
Yeah, exactly.
But one of the worst times, and this was horrible, Stanley Weston, the publisher, calls me and opens up a package from Theo Errett, our Los Angeles photographer, and says, look at this. And it's bikini-clad hot babes wrestling in an apartment. We're going to call this apartment wrestling. We're going to make a fortune out of this. This is how he spoke.
Stanley?
Yeah. And I don't care what the promoters say. So I typically brought magazines to the arenas. But guys like Chief J. Strongbow would ask me, Bill, you know, any cover that I'm on. So we put them on a cover, and I'd bring the magazine, and I'd say, here, don't show this to anyone. So all the boys would be, oh, man, after shooting porn. I said, I never shot any of this stuff. And Vince Sr. and Willie Gilsenberg, the other promoter in New York, they went crazy. This is porn. And I said, you have to talk to Mr. Weston about it. They can't boss us around. And that lasted a long time. Eventually, apartment wrestling stopped selling. It died. Theo Errett died. I'm glad that apartment wrestling's dead, but I'm sorry that Theo died. Dan Shockett became, his alter ego was Dave Maul. Which was he was the promoter of apartment wrestling.
And this is where you would just have, because now they have a thing where people can write the scripts for the girls' matches, right?
Like, Yeah.
Put her in a headlock now, bite her toe. But this was just a couple chicks in an apartment kind of wrestling around in bikinis.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't think they were wrestling around. I think they were posed.
Oh, okay.
I only shot it once. Randy Gordon, who became the head of the State Athletic Commission in New York, and he was one of our boxing editors, he did a wrestling column. And one time he had two girls that wanted to be models and apartment wrestling, so I shot it, and it was like, it's not what I thought it was going to be. It was like the Playboy photographers. Well, it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
But that was bad.
What else are you writing about in your book? Like, is it a kind of a chronological experience of your time in the business?
It's not chronological.
It's just vignettes and stories and
yes,
anecdotes.
Because I read in the bathroom, mm-hmm. and I like to go. I'm a chapter jumper.
Yeah.
So that one of the
Give
other
us a couple stories that you can kind of tell.
Yeah, but they one of the horrible stories. The worst one in there is the Benoit tragedies.
So from just explaining it from your end, or explaining it. So tell me.
I have my own theory, which is not in the book, because the publisher thought it was too intense to spill it out in the book.
About
2 weeks before whatever allegedly happened, I was on AOL and Nancy's ding instant message box.
Because you mentioned Nancy once before. Were you friends with Nancy?
Oh, I loved her to death. Yes. Bad choice of words, but I knew her when Kevin Sullivan was first breaking her in, and she'd always see me go, "Oh, it's Mr. Bill." From Saturday Night Live. So
oh, no.
So her instant message pops up.
Because Nancy had a great personality. She's very
great.
Funny.
She was great. Her instant message pops up, and I said, "It's me, Mr. Bill." I answered first, so it says it's Chris, and Daniel is sitting on my lap. So we talked a little, and they said, "How come you're not working for us in the WWE? Do you want me to talk to somebody?" I said, "I'm good where I am. I'm really fine. I'm very loyal to whoever I work for." So that was the last time I had heard from him. I remember seeing him on the road with Eddie Guerrero. And he'd always sit in the corner, read a book, and ask me to tell him some bad jokes, Chris. Okay? I always liked him. He was just a quiet, nice guy. When I heard what happened, news trucks from Philadelphia came to my house, and people thought that I killed my wife or something. People in my neighborhood don't know what I do.
Right.
A lot of them don't. So, and then I was on MSNBC, and I gave my theory of what I think happened. And Dr. Martin Abend, who was one of their crime reporters, said, "I never heard that, and maybe you're right." Okay? So I'm going to tell you what's not in the book, what I think may have happened, and I may be totally wrong, and people are going to go, "This is ridiculous. How could you even think of this?" I think somehow Chris got in some sort of trouble. I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was after or whatever, but I think something happened. I think when he got home, Nancy and his son were already dead. And I understand that husbands and wives kill each other sometimes. They do. But not the boy. Mm-hmm. This is what didn't make sense to me. To me, if a hit, a murder, is done in a professional way, they can make it look like you did it and you committed suicide as well. To this day, the Chris Benoit I know couldn't have done that at all. To me, they were dead. He got in some sort of trouble. They were murdered. And when he got home, he was murdered, and they set it up to make it look like he committed suicide. Oh, only again because I knew they had a volatile relationship, he and Nancy. There were a lot of issues and all that. But because of Daniel, the boy, and how enamored he was with Daniel, I still today can't fathom that he could do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's definitely the mystery of all ages. You know, something that we'll never
maybe
know.
Maybe I'm right.
Well, it's as plausible as what the official explanation is.
Which is not. There isn't one.
And there isn't one. It's been very kind of shady and dropped and all that sort of thing.
And what do you think?
I don't know, man. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to kind of, I would say if I'm talking rationally, I would say concussions. I would say the same thing that happened with Junior Seau and all these type of guys they're having the talking with Chris Nowinski about how the brain hardens and gives you dementia and makes you hear voices and basically
I've thought of that
drives
too.
You insane. You know?
I've thought of that too, but I just, it's Daniel, the son, that makes no sense in this.
And nothing makes sense about it.
Yeah.
You know, so it could be concussions, it could be rage, it could be demonic possession for all I know.
Maybe.
There's no real closure on that. You know what I mean? So like you said, it's one of those things that I don't think we'll ever know. And it's cool that you talked about it in the book.
Because, it is, but again, that theory is not.
Yeah, it's not in there. But I mean, then that you've seen the tragedies, you've seen the good stuff, the funny stuff. Tell us some more. I mean, you've seen all these guys. I mean, we went out in Vegas years and years ago. I'm sure. Did you ever go out with the guys
with Effin' Barry?
Effin' Barry. Did you ever go out with Flair at all? Or did you go out with any? Like, did you ever get kind of dragged along?
I was on an airplane when Flair mooned everybody one time. He opened up his robe. We were going Jim Crockett Promotions, and he had nothing on underneath.
Is this a commercial?
Yeah,
flight?
Yeah.
He would travel in his robe, or he would go to the bathroom.
Sometimes. Sometimes he traveled in his robe. Depends what time it was. One night, a lot of the guys know that when I was a kid, I might have been the first backyard wrestler. Hmm. I grew up in Maspeth, Queens, and there was an apartment building. We lived on the apartment 5G, Billy's place. And we had grass down around the building with a chain link fence, and that was a wrestling ring. Mm-hmm. And I used to challenge people that I'll give you 25 cents if you can break out of my Buddy Rogers figure four leg lock. And nobody was able to do it. And so I always wanted to be one of those. I wanted to be a wrestler since I was growing up. My parents would go, do something else in the business because it's not a job for a nice Jewish kid. So eventually my father had to pay a fine in the building to the maintenance crew of $100 because from all the wrestling there was a bald spot made on the grass, but that became my signature, my bald spot.
Your bald spot, yeah.
So it really did, but
did
I'm getting
have
to
a
that
grass
because
comb over?
Right, exactly. A grass comb over. I'll never let that go, by the way, the comb over.
It's your gimmick.
Yes, it'll always be there. So to fast forward, this chapter is about guys that invited me in the ring. And one time I was in San Antonio. Shawn Michaels had his school in San Antonio along with Jose Lothario. And somewhere while he was training Daniel Bryan and all that, he said, after, why don't you come in the ring? I said, fine. He said, what do you want to do? I said, I'll shoot you into the ropes. You come off, I'll hit you with a flying dropkick, and I'll put you in my figure four in 6 seconds. He says, you're going to do a flying dropkick? I said, yeah. I'd done this 1,000,000,000 times on the grass. I beat everybody with it. I held a Maspeth championship. So I whip Sean into the ropes, drop kick, he goes down, put him in the figure four. I had something in my pocket. I don't remember what it was. So now after that's happening, I need to get a plane an hour afterwards. And I get on a plane. I'm sitting next to a very talkative old lady who can actually out-talk me, which shocked
That's
me.
That's rare.
Yeah, it really is. And I start feeling pain on my left side. And I'm like, she says, are you having a heart attack? I said, I was just wrestling. I think I may have broken my ribs. She, you're a wrestler? And she's like, everybody's like, oh, who is it? Who is? I got off the plane. Someone met me at the airport. One of my friends took me to a local hospital, and I had broken 3 ribs because I fell wrong.
Wow.
I fell wrong and broke 3 ribs wrestling Shawn Michaels at his training school. Yeah.
But see, now you know the pain. It's like people say, well, Apter's never been in the ring. I digress. Yes, he sure has. You know?
There are guys who used me around the ring when I used to shoot, and I loved it. I loved being part of the show. When I was shooting pictures around the ring, let's say of Ricky Steamboat against Ernie Ladd, the Jim Crockett Promotions, that put 10,000 people in the audience there, and Ricky Steamboat at the beginning of the match would come over and shake my hand. I'd shake his hand, all this. Ernie Ladd would come over to shake my hand, and I'd give him the Flair gimmick. I'd go almost there and then pull my hand back, and the crowd went crazy, and Ernie Ladd went crazy. I used to love doing that stuff. Then there were wrestlers who, when I'd flash from the camera, they'd make like it hurts his eyes, and they'd say, tell the referee he can't shoot at ringside. So.
Use that as part of the match.
Yeah.
With all the matches you saw, who were some of the greatest workers that you would see night in, night out, like just consistency of just being excellent?
I've pissed off a lot of people by saying this. Mil Máscaras.
Wow.
And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you. Everybody said he never let the other guy. It was never 50-50 in the matches.
Yeah, right? I can tell you.
Well, you know, this is what I like to do.
Not for you.
Right? This is what I like to do. Gary Hart always told me a classic story. Whenever Mill would buy gum, he'd come into the dressing room chewing the gum. He said, "The gum is for me, not for the boys." So the reason, when I was watching the shows in New York from the Olympic Auditorium, scary imitation.
Yeah,
huh?
It was good.
And I love him. He got Hurricane Sandy when that hit in the Philadelphia area, and I had a tree come through my house. He called me. You okay? Mm. Yeah. So His real name isn't Mel Moskowitz, by the way. It's Mel Moskowitz. I don't know if you know that.
Mel Moskowitz.
Mel Moskowitz. He's from the Bronx.
Jewish Mexican.
Right. A Jewsigan. Never mind. Anyway. By the way, I'm not voting for Donald Trump. I love Mexican people.
Yes.
So, okay.
Just for the record. Yes. So you're saying how great.
And I'm Jewish, so it's okay.
Even more strange. Right.
So when I was growing up, I used to see him on the Olympic Auditorium shows. And he captured my fancy because he made it look so fluid. Anytime somebody, Black Gordman or Goliath, would put him in a hold, he was able to work his way out of it in a fluid manner, effortless. He made it look beautiful and the way it was supposed to look. And he captured my imagination. We had him on a lot of covers. And when he went with Eddie Einhorn from the White Sox and Pedro Martinez and went opposition to Vince McMahon Sr. Vince was crazy that we were putting him on the cover, but he looked good. He looked great. He took very good care of himself. He worked great. It didn't matter to me or the publisher that and King Kong Maska says the guy sucks because he doesn't work with you. It didn't matter. Mm-hmm. He looked great. He worked great. He was drawing big crowds. So
he was selling issues of your magazine.
Yeah, my magazine, Stanley Weston. I'm sorry, wrong answer.
What about as far as popularity goes? Is it when you're at? I mean, who had the biggest reaction?
Well, like Dusty Rhodes was incredible. I'm so sorry we lost him.
Yeah,
I was at the funeral, and I had seen him a year before. They had me do a pilot show for the WWE Network, and he was one of my guests, and I'm so glad I got to see him again.
Because people forget, you know, once again, you know, if you're not a child of the 70s or 80s, how popular Dusty was.
Oh, my God.
Super, super, super popular.
You know who else was so popular? And they say, well, it was just one territory. But in the magazines, it was Johnny Walker, Mr. Wrestling number 2. Hmm. If you went to Georgia, 2 was selling out every place. He had the Freebirds. I mean, that was such a red hot territory, and he was on top there. And when people talk about popularity, to hear 17,000 fans at the Omni all screaming out two, it was great. It was great. You before you became Y2J. Seriously, I mean, your popularity was huge.
Well, I would think from that era. I remember being in the ring with Austin. Or Rock, you know. Even when Hogan came back in 2002, his reactions were ridiculously huge.
Sure,
you know, you could. I mean, Hogan in the 80s,
yeah,
popular.
Sure,
as popular as Dusty, or
yeah. Well, it depends where he was.
Mm-hmm.
The Road Warriors. You talk about two guys who were trying to be the biggest MFers in the whole world and so tough.
Trying to be so mean,
and they got pops from that audience. The audience turned them into the biggest baby faces.
They were getting
the
road
world.
Warrior pops.
Oh,
which is
man.
The term in wrestling we use. Oh, yes. I got a road warrior pop, which means it's the biggest pop you can get.
Yeah,
you know,
the divas were getting road warrior moms, by the way. But go ahead.
What about as far as heel heat?
Well, we have to take it generation by generation. I mean, when I was growing up, King Curtis, Bulldog Brower, Crazy Luke Graham, Nature Boy Buddy Rogers, who I never thought I'd photograph him. He was one of my heroes, and he made a comeback in 1979 in Florida. My father calls me and says, you'll never believe who it just, I said, got to be an imposter. And I get a call the next day, hello, Billy, this is Buddy Ryan. I couldn't believe it was him. But it goes generation to generation.
Talk about when you were ringside taking pictures in the 70s and 80s, maybe.
Wow, God, it's almost hard, so hard to remember some of the
I just didn't know if, regionally, like you mentioned, like Hogan in certain places.
It was anyone. It was anyone who opposed Sting, Dusty, Nikita Koloff. When he went against Maganum D.A. in the Best of 7 series, horribly hated anything to do with anti-American Ivan Koloff. When he came to New York and worked against Bruno, wrestled, not worked against, wrestled against Bruno Sammartino. You talk about babyface pops and Bruno. With no music. There was no theme music back then.
Oh, they would just come out?
21,000 fans. The music was Bruno, Bruno. To this day, I can still hear that resounding. Pedro Morales, and it wasn't just the Latin American community that was there. Anybody who headlined the Garden, superstar Billy Graham. You talk about someone that got incredible heat, and he was the first coming of what was going to be Hulk Hogan, Austin Idol, all the guys of that
Jesse Ventura.
Look. Yeah, it all started with superstar
Steiner,
Billy Graham.
Scott
Steiner,
yeah.
Yeah, it all started with... I don't know if I'd put Scott Steiner in that same...
I'm saying I think he took a lot of what he did from Superstar Billy Graham.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I think there was definitely that element of it in there.
Best time I ever had was Superstar Billy Graham. And this started a promoter and a promotion that I wish I had never gotten involved in. I was shooting pictures of Billy Graham. We took a walk down Broadway in New York, and he had the WWF belt with him. And there was one point I saw right in Times Square a garbage can. I said, why don't you get up on the garbage can and pose? And he tore his shirt off and he poses, and it made the cover of Inside Wrestling magazine. And hundreds of fans and the police going, get back, what are you doing? You know, so we didn't have a license to do this. And he was wrestling at the Garden that night, and this guy comes over and he says, I'm going to be a wrestling promoter. I live in Queens. I said, fine. He says, you got a wife or a girlfriend? I own a dress shop there. Can you get me some wrestlers? Little by little, I got him involved. It turned out to be, do you remember Herb Abrams?
Yeah, oh yeah.
So that's how this started. I brought Chief J. Strongbow and Billy White Wolf to his store. And he had a lot of money, and he started this wrestling promotion, and eventually he got on TV, yeah. As you know, with his UWF.
He had a pay-per-view, I believe.
Yeah, yeah, and then he went crazy, and he became allegedly addicted to drugs and everything. And people said to me, you helped start that guy? I helped start Sony. I was in Grand Union Supermarket in Massapequa Park when I lived on Long Island, and I'd go maybe midnight, 1 a.m. all the time to do my shopping, okay? And there was this little Italian-looking guy happened to be there almost every time I was there. So one time, I just turned around. I said, can I help you? He says, you Bill Apta? Yeah. My name's Pete. It's Pete. Yeah, I wrestle. I'm looking to get into wrestling. It turned out to be Taz.
I can tell when he said, you Bill Apta?
Yeah, Bill Apta. There are so many guys I helped kickstart the careers of. Like that. I want to go on record because there's a rumor on a podcast that a lot of fans at Ring of Honor stopped me about. They said, Hogan's going crazy saying you got him the part in Rocky III. He got that on his own merits. What happened was Stallone's office called the magazine office, and they were looking for a type to play Thunderlips in Rocky III. They called me. I sent them pictures of superstar Billy Graham and this new guy named Hulk Hogan. And they said there was no internet or anything, so we had a FedEx overnight. So I get a call the next day saying, can you send us more pictures of Hogan and have him call us and get in touch with us? We may be interested in pursuing this. At that point, they were part of the magazine band was in there, and I called Arnold Skoland, who was one of the agents for Vince Sr., and I called Hulk's mother, and I said, Stallone's trying to get a hold of him, etc. So eventually, Skoland delivered the message. And all these years, Hogan thought not only it was a joke, but he thought that Skoland, Arnold Skoland, who I loved, he was one of my dearest friends, tipped him off to that. So after the Rocky thing happened, I know Vince Sr. didn't want him to take the part. He was very
good. Actually, I think it was also Vern.
Vern didn't. Yeah. They didn't want him involved in this.
Yeah.
And I was between the two federations at this time. And after it all happened, we put pictures of it on the cover. His mother sent us the pictures as a thank you note. And the office of PWI still probably has that. But it became around the internet that Apta says he got Hogan the part. I didn't. I helped kickstart. I sent pictures of Graham, too.
Right.
They wanted Hogan. They wanted to pursue
that.
So Hogan got it on his own merits. I didn't get him the part, but I helped get the ball rolling.
You helped facilitate it. Yeah.
Sure.
What did
you
think, from working so many years, how the old school territories were when Vince took over and then when WrestleMania was announced? Because it was such a big gamble. What was the mindset of the industry? Did you think it was going to be a success? Did you have any
We were thrown out at that point. So our mentality at the magazines was, we hope this bombs. And Jim Crockett Promotions. See, Jim Crockett Promotions pick up the ball, because not only did Jim Crockett and Dusty Rhodes say to me, you know, you have freedom to do what you want, we're going to give you a segment on TBS every Sunday. It was Pro Wrestling Illustrated Scouting Reports. And Dusty said, Willie, you can talk. And I said, I've always wanted it. My first goal was not to get into the magazines. My goal was, I wanted to do a wrestling talk show my whole life. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be not necessarily a commentator, but the backstage guy doing the interviews before you guys go out there. And I still do that for a lot of the indies. So we were like, they didn't want any part of us. So we were like, we called it, we thought it was Wrestling Mania. So we got it wrong.
Wrestling
first.
Mania.
But I snuck into the first press conference.
Oh, really?
We had Liberace and all these people. I snuck in, shot pictures, and at that point I was in, so they couldn't throw me out because there was a lot of press there, and I kept saying, what's Bill Apter doing? Who invited Bill Apter? You know, this type of
murmuring
thing. Yeah. And we weren't for it, because had they cooperated with us and kept us going and letting when Hogan won the title from the Iron Sheik, we had a photo assistant up in the stand shooting pictures. He bought a camera. They were checking him at the Garden because he was coming in with this big bag, and they said, what's that in the saran wrap? And he says, oh, it's my lunch. I'm on a special diet and I can't eat the food here. Guard lets him in. So that's how
so
we got the pictures.
Cameras in.
Yeah. Now, I never did it.
Right.
I never wanted to be embarrassed
sure.
to where I'd be taken backstage and by Vince. I never did that. Okay, I always send people.
But you had the minions to do, yeah. You mentioned Willie. I know you do a lot of great imitations, but, I mean, Wonderful Willie is a great one. You've had this guy for years.
Well, Wonderful Willie is my Jimmy Valiant, Boogie Woogie Man, Jimmy Valiant. When guys would come to the office to have their picture taken, they'd have to wrestle me for the Cow Belt Championship Office Wrestling. And Jimmy Valiant did a promo one time. He says, Willie! Wonderful Willie, you've been a thorn in my side. I said, Wonderful Willie, wow. And eventually, Reggie Parks made me a belt to replace the cardboard belt. Wonderful Willie, the Cow Championship.
Give us a little Wonderful Willie.
Well, Wonderful Willie sounds like Dusty Rhodes. Diamond Dallas Page, you may come in here to be the little Wonderful Willie, but Wonderful Willie is styling and profiling and boogie woogieing. Yeah.
Who else did you get imitation of?
I can imitate almost anybody in the business.
Really?
Yeah, I go back. I think last time you and I got together, I gave you some Grand Wizard of Wrestling. Grand Wizard
Give me
was.
Some Grand Wizard.
Grand Wizard. It's been your pleasure to hear my dulcet, round, pear shaped tones of the Grand Wizard. Bruno was one of my. Now, you have to ask me, Bruno. Ask me about Bobby Duncum. If I hate Bobby Duncum.
Bruno, do you hate Bobby Duncum?
You know something? This Bobby Duncum guy is very tough. But, you know, I don't hate Bobby Duncum. I just hold a lot of animosity toward him. He always said that. He always said he didn't hate somebody. I just hold a lot of animosity. And Pedro Morales, of course, he used to get so passionate when he was on an interview. Somebody would say, hey, you be Vince McMahon. And you say to me, Pedro, I understand that Stan Stasiak is looking.
Yeah, Pedro, Stan Stasiak.
No, do your Vince.
Oh, okay. Pedro, I understand that Stan Stasiak is on your case. He wants to take your title away with what a maneuver.
Well, Vince, you know, I'm a little nervous, but I am ready for any kind of action, babe. I don't care if I have to be picking up a chair. I am ready for him, babe.
The best one, too. Give me a little bit more of the Shawn Michaels. Shawn, Diesel's coming after you to take your title.
I can't do a Shawn Michaels.
You just did a good one before. Like, could you do that, Bill? What are you talking
about?
Oh, no.
He always talked like there was a comedian named Jackie Leonard. When he get together with Triple H, he always talked like Jackie Leonard. What are you, a little cocker? That was throw me some more names, because I do a lot
The superstar Billy Graham.
He was almost like Dusty Rhodes. Superstar Billy Graham just did. He had. It was almost like the same voice.
Okay,
there.
What about a Ric Flair?
I never really did a good Ric Flair.
He was at the Lith. How are you doing? Third?
Well, he did that, and he'd go, "When you talk about Chris Jericho." You have to pronounce everything.
Could you do more obscure ones, like a Ricky Steamboat?
Well, the Captain Lou Albano, brother. The Captain's got it all. Ability, agility, guts, maneuverability, backward movement. He was great. And then you got Freddie Blassie, of course. You know, I can't do ethnic jokes on here.
So many great ones.
And Buddy Rogers, when I was a little kid, he'd get on TV and the broadcaster would say, Buddy, tonight you have to be the broadcaster. Ask me about my match against Eduardo Carpentier.
Buddy, tell us about your match against Eduardo Carpentier.
Well, you know something? Eduardo Carpentier might have the body, but he doesn't have it up here like the nature boy pal.
He always called everybody pal. Antonino Rocca was great because the broadcaster would ask him about his opponent. He said, well, you know this guy, he talks a lot. He's a papagayo, you know, parakeet. That's what Rocca
sounds like. Scarface.
Yeah.
Exactly. What did Vince Sr. sound like?
Vince Sr. was just like this when I talked to him. I'd call him. I'd say the best line he ever threw. They were changing the WWWF to the WWF, Worldwide Wrestling Federation, to the World Wrestling Federation. So he calls me. He says, "We're going to take the WWWF and make it the WWF." And I said, "Why?" He says, "Because the whole world knows the world is wide." Hangs up. That was it. There's so many other people I do. I don't have my list in front of me here. I do a lot of, I do a lot of celebrity imitations. Of course, I tried with you on my after chat to do the Jerry Lewis memory test.
Mm.
You remember that?
No, I forgot. I failed the memory test.
Can we try this?
Sure.
Okay, there are 10 of these things, and you have to repeat them right after me.
All right.
And this has nothing to do. The first one is, don't forget, Bill Apter's book, Is Wrestling Fixed? I didn't know it was broken. Okay, so repeat each one of these, and let's see if you can get to number 10. All right? One hen.
One hen.
One hen, two ducks.
One hen, two ducks.
One hen, two ducks, three squawking geese.
One hen, two ducks, three squawking geese.
One hen, two ducks, three squawking geese, four Limerick oysters.
One hen, two ducks, three squawking geese, four Limerick oysters.
One hen, two ducks, three squawking geese, four Limerick oysters, five corpulent porpoises.
One hen, two ducks, three squawking geese, four porpoises.
Limerick?
Four limericks.
Oysters.
Oh, five oysters.
Corpulent.
Six corpulent dolphins.
No, six
corpulent porpoises.
You want to hear the whole thing?
Yeah.
This was an announcer's test that I heard Jerry Lewis do when I was a kid, and I audio taped it. And so the whole thing is one hen, two ducks, three squawking geese, four Limerick oysters, five corpulent porpoises, six pairs of Don Alverzo's tweezers, 7,000 Macedonians in full battle array, eight brass monkeys from the ancient sacred secret crypts of Egypt, nine apathetic, sympathetic, diabetic old men on roller skates with a marked propensity towards procrastination and sloth, and 10 lyrical, spherical, diabolical denizens of the deep who haul stall around the corner of the core of the quay of the quarry all at the same time. On that note,
two final questions. What's the best match you've ever seen, if you had to pick one?
It goes by generation again.
Okay, well,
Dory Funk Jr. against Jack Briscoe. Anything Ric Flair did with Ricky Steamboat. Ricky Steamboat, Randy Savage. Well, I mean, those were the
memorable
and a classic match that nobody will talk about. And I'm bringing another guy up again. This was back in the old Pedro Martinez territory. It was an outdoor match. It was pouring rain, and Mil Máscaras and Ivan Koloff were wrestling, and it was poetry in motion. Mm. It really was. Yeah. But Bruno Sammartino against Ken Patera. And in recent years, you know, what I want to bring up is people say you've been doing this almost 50 years. Why and how do you keep doing this? And I could cite great matches that I've seen in the past, even 5 years. John Cena and Cesaro. Mm. I mean, they're great matches. I love it. The reason is that if you don't change with this business, you get left behind.
Absolutely.
I never hated what this business has become. So many people are like, you must be so bitter because it's not pure wrestling anymore. And again, like I said at the beginning of your wonderful podcast, is the window dressing's changed. It's still what they do in the ring is still the same thing. It's still wrestling.
Right.
And I changed with the product because I like what's going on today. People say, my God, how could you compare it with the old school? I don't. It's a different product. It's marketed differently. So go with it. I love it. I love the people in it. I love you guys are my family. Beside my real family, I go, yeah, you and my dog. You people are my family. I come sometimes backstage to the WWE shows with no camera, no recorders or anything, just to be with the family.
Just to hang out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. You wrote a lot about the family. Is wrestling fixed? They didn't know it was broken. And you got to take us away with your classic patented Moon River rap.
Well, I can rap any song. We don't have to do Moon River.
I want to hear Moon River.
Any song. Well, Moon River, my best friend, Paul Big Bear, he's 6'8", 385 pounds, used to wrestle as a concrete cowboy. We entertain at senior homes. And during the week, by the way, beside OneWrestling.com, I help people with disabilities to find jobs for a wonderful nonprofit that I work for. So Paul and I entertain at senior homes, and sometimes I'll do a beautiful ballad like, Moon River wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday. And the old people love it. But the nurses are like, So I put on a side baseball cap and I do, yo, Moon River wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday. You dream maker, you freaking heartbreaker. Or a Barry Manilow. I love Barry Manilow. I'll do, her name was Lola. She was a showgirl with yellow feathers in her hair and a dress cut down there at the Copacabana. Yeah, just
would.
Yeah. Thank you so much for, and I want to tell you, not because I'm on here, I want to tell you, through the years that I've known you, you've always been one of my favorite people. I remember when your first book came out, you let me do interviews for an hour and a half with you. Not just, and I know, it's great publicity. Sure, it was. But because we developed a friendship
talking with
during,
you,
likewise. Yeah. I'm shy. You, I'm going to come out of my shell.
Come out of your shell one of these days, man. Thanks to Bill Apter, his new book, Is Wrestling Fixed? I didn't know it was broken. You can pick that up as of October 13th on Amazon.com. He's got so many great stories, so many laughs. You're going to love this book. I know I do. I love Bill. I've known him for so many years. He's such a funny, charismatic, wacky guy, and his book comes across the exact same way. And if you order yourself a copy of Bill's new book, please use the TIJ Amazon links to do it. You find him by going to podcastone.com. Click on the Support Our Show Sponsors banner there at the top of the page. Then hit the Talk is Jericho button. All my Amazon links are right there. All right. Down to the last couple American dates in the Y2J Fall Tour. So strange. October 2nd, this Friday in Trenton. October 3rd in New York City, Madison Square Garden. The 25th anniversary of my career to the day. Versus Kevin Owens for the Intercontinental Championship. It's going to be televised on the air on the WWE Network. I'm bringing in some of my old friends that I started out with. Don Callis, The Natural, Cyrus, whatever name you want to call him, the Jackal, he's going to be there. Lance Storm is going to be there. Dr. Luther, Lenny St. Clair is going to be there. Some of my best friends for the last 25 years are going to be hanging out at Madison Square Garden. I hope to see you guys there. It's a big show. Brock Lesnar versus Big Show, Dudley's versus New Day, Jericho versus Owens, Rollins versus Cena in a steel cage. It's going to be one of the greatest shows in Madison Square Garden history, and I'm very, very excited and honored to be a part of it. Also excited to go to Saudi Arabia for the first time. We're hitting Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, October 8th, 9th, and 10th. And then Mexico, 16th, Merida, 17th, Mexico City, 18th, Monterrey. So excited to regresa a Mexico. And October 30th, back on the Fozzy Groove as we go out with the Kiss Navy on the Kiss Cruise. Sold out, man, all the way to Jamaica. Kiss and Fozzy, Steel Panther, Lita Ford. What more do you want? And then after that, the Cinderblock Party goes back to the UK, back to Europe with Nonpoint and Sumo Psycho in tow. That starts November 13th in Rotterdam. We're going to Vienna, Hamburg, Berlin, Cologne, France, Luxembourg. Then we're going back to the UK, hitting London November 26th at the Islington Academy. You got to come check it out. Manchester, Southampton, Birmingham. Go check out FozzyRock.com for all the gigs, all of the shows, all the VIP info. Come and experience it. Come hang out with me. You get to meet me. What more do you want at the VIP experience with Fozzy? FozzyRock.com. And thanks to you guys once again for being here, for listening to this show twice a week. I'm glad I'm able to bring it to you for free. Thanks to my great sponsors, Casper Mattress. Use the promo code Jericho at Casper.com. Get $50 off your mattress. DraftKings, use the promo code Y2J to play for free. SeatGeek, use the promo code ChrisJ. Get a $20 rebate off your first purchase. DDP Yoga, go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho and JakeTheSnakeMovie.com to get a great deal on DDP Yoga and to find out where you can watch the great documentary, The Resurrection of Jake the Snake. Thank you so much for being here. Thanks to Bill Apter. Thanks to AC/DC for still being a great rock and roll band. Thanks to Jack Slade and Chris Slade for helping me hook up a great, great night and a great time. And speaking of which, or the great times continue on Friday when another crazy rocker is going to be here. Justin Hawkins from The Darkness. Such a funny guy. It's a great show. Calling all the way from London, all the way from Switzerland, wherever the hell he was. I don't know. I do know that he was great. You're going to love it. We'll see you then. And a big yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.